But once you begin to understand that Mahmoud Ahmadinejad believes he is essentially the Islamic John the Baptist. He believes he's supposed to lay the groundwork for the coming of the Mahdi. So what is he doing? Well, he is feverishly trying to build, buy, or steal nuclear weapons. He is building military alliances with three nuclear powers, Russia, China, and North Korea. He is working directly with North Korea to build long-range ballistic missiles capable of taking these nuclear warheads, once they're finished with them, and delivering them into Israel and eventually into the United States, because that's what the theology, the eschatology, demands of them. Now, once you understand what these guys are thinking and how deep-rooted this is for Ahmadinejad, Glenn Beck and others have asked me, well, does this guy really believe this, or is it just, saber-rattling? Is it just trying to whip up the masses? Well, it certainly is whipping up the masses, but this is something that Ahmadinejad deeply believes. And I describe him in the book and go back into his life story from Iranian sources, and what you find is he was born in a very poor but very religious family. I mean, he was learning the Quran, memorizing it, at the age of five. Now, in 1979, when the Islamic Revolution began, he was not a major player. He was not really much of a player at all. During the Iran-Iraq War, he's not a major general or military commander. He's not distinguished in any way during that war. Instead, he is going to graduate school. And what he did was get a PhD in traffic management. Now, I'm not sure exactly where you're all from or how traffic is in your neck of the woods, but it must be hellish in Tehran, right? To get a doctorate in traffic management, so you don't get the immediate sense that this guy's thinking, he certainly believed in this issue of wanting the Messiah to come, but he didn't seem to be planning a political career. But apparently traffic got so bad in the capital city that he decided, I'm going to run for mayor. And he had three things on his platform: fix the traffic problems, to make sure the garbage got taken out, and I'm not kidding, he called himself the little street sweeper, well, because he's like 5'4", and so he thought, well, little will fit, and then, people want their trash taken out, so I can do that. And the third issue was, and I'll lay the groundwork for the coming of the Messiah. Well, that's an ambitious thing. I don't know how you run for mayor in your town, but, generally we don't have that, but that was the platform. Now, he won, and then in April of 2005, he decided, you know what? I'm going to run for the presidency of the country. Now, not to deal with trash or traffic, but to prepare for the coming of the Messiah. And his initial speech is all about how he's going to do this. And I quote it in the book. But what's interesting is when he announced for the presidency in April 2005, almost no reporter showed up for his press conference. They just thought, this guy has no chance. It's not a story. The first poll that came out put Ahmadinejad at 2.8% support. Now, even my candidates did not do as badly as that. But 2 months later, on June 24th, 2005, Ahmadinejad became the president of Iran. Now, how did that happen? I describe that in the book, and I don't have time to go through that tonight. But the point for our purposes is, he believes God chose him. He believes that God chose him because he is supposed to be, in his mind, effectively the John the Baptist for the coming of the Messiah. And from his first moments, during his inaugural speech, when he put together his cabinet was required to sign pledges of allegiance, not to him, but to the Mahdi. And as you go through all this stuff, you realize this is really what he has believed from childhood. He was part of a society in the 1980s that wanted to bring back the Messiah and prepare the way, a society that was so radical that the Ayatollah Khomeini banned it as being too nutty. Now, when the Ayatollah Khomeini bans you as being too nutty, you are really out there. But there he is now, the president of the country, with full support of the supreme leader, the Ayatollah Khamenei. So the question for policymakers in Washington is, you've got to understand the eschatology, the worldview, the end times worldview of the leadership of Iran. Otherwise, there's no way to stop them. But a deeper question is, once you begin to look at that, say, how would you stop them? How do you convince someone, how do you convince a regime that believes it's been chosen by God to annihilate Judeo-Christian civilization as we know it from doing so? I mean, sure, they'll be happy to sit down and have a caramel macchiato with you in Brussels or, you know, Geneva or wherever, but that's only to buy time to get the weapons and the delivery systems that they need. But if you walk into that room and you say, we're going to negotiate with these Iranian leaders, and you don't understand their worldview, you're going to have a tough time knowing how to build a strategy that's successful. And honestly, I'm not sure that there is a diplomatic strategy that will be successful, but I know that the current president during the campaign said, look, we've dealt with bigger problems than this before. We dealt with the Soviet Union. They were the big kahuna at the time. They had nuclear weapons. They had long-range missiles to deliver them. And what did we do? Did we go to war? No. He said, we just sat down and negotiated and were able to find common ground, and the Cold War was won without firing a shot. Now, that's all accurate, but not relevant to this specific situation. Why? Because Soviet leaders had a worldview. Soviet leaders were communists. Communists are atheists. Atheists, by definition, neither believe in God nor in an afterlife. So if you credibly convince a Soviet leader that if they nuke you, you will nuke them, that they personally will be annihilated, snuffed out, you begin to concentrate that communist mind. He thinks, well, I do want to bury the West. I want all power and wealth and women to myself, but I mean, if they're going to kill me, then no, okay, I won't nuke them. I mean, President Reagan was able to credibly deter them. Why? Because they were evil, but they still believed in life. Their own. I mean, not the lives of all the people that they killed, you know, in the death camps or the Jews or whatever, but themselves, they wanted to preserve their own lives. That is not the case in the current leadership in Iran. This is an apocalyptic death cult running Iran today. An apocalyptic death cult. Shia Islam glorifies death. And these leaders, Ahmadinejad and Khamenei, believe that the wind is at their back, that God is on their side, that the end of history is at hand, and that they will be the glorious saviors, the forerunners of the ultimate savior in their view. And by the way, they believe that Jesus is coming back as the deputy, the lieutenant of the Mahdi. And that Jesus will force the entire world to either bow down and worship Allah or be killed. That's right out of their writings. So, Washington doesn't understand the current leadership in Iran. And that's a problem. Now, the new leadership in Israel, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, they do understand it. I sat down, I had many conversations with Netanyahu about this. I describe those and quote the conversations I've had, the interviews I did with him in the book. He understands how dangerous this is. The problem is there is a train wreck coming between the United States and Israel over the issue of Iran. Every Israeli leader up till now, no matter what disagreements they had with Washington over different worldviews of understanding what's happening in different parts of the world, particularly the epicenter, they always knew they had a friend in the White House. That they had a friend, maybe not in the State Department underneath, but usually the Secretary of State was a reasonable friend. And they believed, as Israeli leaders up till now, that ultimately, no matter what happened, the United States would be there for Israel, come what may. It is not clear that this is the case. I would argue, and have to my Israeli friends, you need to prepare yourself for the coldest season in 61 years of U.S.-Israeli relations. And this is a problem because Netanyahu is building a war cabinet. He has literally reached not just across the aisle, he reached out to his biggest political rival, Ehud Barak, to be his new defense minister. You have to understand, Barak was the man that defeated Netanyahu in 1999 and became the prime minister. So these guys are big-time rivals. But Netanyahu reached out to him and said, look, we disagree on almost every issue that there is. But We believe in the survival of the state of Israel. We believe that this is the only homeland of the Jewish people. And you and I need to work together, no matter what our differences, to defend this country. We are probably going to have to go to war with Iran, and we need to work together. And Barak, against his party's better wishes, said yes. So Netanyahu is preparing a war cabinet. He has a war cabinet. He's preparing to go to war, if he has to, with Iran. But he has something hanging over his head. The worry, not expressed explicitly publicly yet, but we have to consider it, that when he comes to Washington and tells Washington, look, if we don't figure out something fast, Israel's going to have to take matters into its own hands, her own hands. But what if the administration says, if you do that, we will never sell you a weapon system to replace what you lose ever again? What does Israel do? This is a train wreck coming between our country that we love so dearly and Israel, which we love so dearly and which God has chosen in his own sovereignty, just because he did.